IPVanish protects every device you own, your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IPVanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio and take control of your privacy with IPVanish. IPVanish protects every device you own, your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IPVanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio and take control of your privacy with IPVanish.
Netflix has gotten pretty good at doing true crime docuseries, and one that particularly struck out to me was Bad Vegan. Have you guys seen the show yet? Do you remember this story? It played out in the news and the tabloids, especially in the local papers here in New York, such as the New York Post, and was featured in Page Six all the time. It was a mind-blowing story of New York vegan restaurateur Sarma Melganales from Pure Food and Wine, which had become the number one spot for celeb spotting and delicious vegan food. Sarma is known as a very smart, capable woman who was the face of this business. You couldn't go in there without seeing her. A lot of people would travel from all over the country to meet her. She's a beautiful blonde. Eventually, Sarma married this sketchy guy, Anthony Strangis, aka Shane Fox, who for several years claimed he worked in special ops and said he had special powers, giving him the ability to secure a passage for Sarma to find Utopia and where her dog would live forever. I know this sounds crazy, but this is what really happened. Sarma ended up transferring almost $2 million from her business accounts at Pure Food and Wine and One Lucky Duck into her personal accounts to give it to this guy, Anthony. Draining the business of all the money and unable to pay employees, workers ended up walking out twice in protest. Ultimately, Sarma and Anthony ended up serving time in prison at Rikers on charges of fraud, among other things. After watching all 4 episodes of Bad Vegan, I think audiences really walked away not knowing if Sarma was a con artist or if she had just like fallen for the wrong dude and had a bad picker and was so psychologically abused that she lost her way. Well, Sarma is here today to tell her side of the story. She has a lot to say.
We are separating one interview into 2 parts because the conversation was just flowing. It was so good.
I'm so excited to have her on our show, and you definitely should make sure that you watch Bad Vegan so that you know a lot of, you know, what we're talking about, but I'm going to make sure that she goes through the whole scenario to give you guys an idea, if you've missed it, what we're talking about. But her story is so unbelievable, and I think she's the perfect guest for Misunderstood because she's someone whose story was narrated by the media, and she has not really had a chance to tell her side in her words.
Today, we are releasing part 1. Tune in on Wednesday for part 2. Make sure you listen to both.
So check this out. I hope you like it. And I'm so excited that Sarma decided to come on to Misunderstood.
Okay, so Sarma, thank you so much for joining me. As I was just telling you before, you are someone that's been on my bucket list of people to have on the show, because I think you are somebody who deserves to be reconsidered. Your story, I feel like, was really misunderstood. And for me, it was really obvious that you are somebody whose story really played out and was narrated in the tabloids at first,
yeah,
and then was put into this documentary or docuseries that Netflix did, which was a huge hit for people that watched it. For you, probably not so much. So, at the beginning here, I just want to clear up with you, what were your thoughts on the documentary?
Well, I ended up kind of having to make my thoughts very clear and outline the things that were sort of blatantly incorrect and clarify what they got wrong, in which I did on my website. And I debated how to do that. It was when it came out, it was just like a fire hose in my face, and I didn't have any support. I did end up getting some support, but you know, I think what happens is a lot of people see it and they are sympathetic and they understand it. And usually the people who understand it are the people who've been through something like that, mm-hmm. certainly. Most people that work in entertainment and filmmaking, they understand, they see what happened in the documentary that was kind of clearly, manipulated. I think the thing that was the most kind of messed up was that phone call in the end of it.
In the end.
Yeah, because it was just so, first of all, it made no sense. And it was really grotesque to kind of show me talking with him that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if you think back to the beginning, when at the very beginning the show opens and it shows me on the phone with him and it shows that I'm recording him and he obviously doesn't know it. And then, you know, I get off the call and I explain, you know, I would never record somebody without their knowing. Can I curse?
Yeah, of course.
I'm like, but that motherfucker, fuck him, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So, of course, if you think about that beginning, it's like that clip at the end. Obviously, I'm recording him. Mm-hmm. I know he's being recorded and I'm playing a role and I'm just trying to, you know, get him saying bonkers stuff. And so all of that was basically for the, you know, it was for the film. I was just, you know, a couple of phone calls like that I recorded. You know, one of them was quite long and he said all kinds of bonkers things. But, you know, I was definitely pretending and it just was so out of place to put that in the end. It like made no sense whatsoever.
Did Netflix or the producers ask you to make those phone calls? Is that why you were doing it?
I mean, I might have offered or either way, but like I was,
but it was
doing
for the show.
I was doing it for the show. Right. I wouldn't have had those conversations like that with him.
Yeah. I think as a viewer, what, you know, was confusing at the end and why there was so much talk after the fact was like, after she's been through all this, if she wasn't in on it, why would she ever talk to him again once she got out of prison? So
and
I think that
was
just
also
question.
Something that I had to kind of, you know, I had to write all of that out mm-hmm. kind of point by point on my website because people were asking me the same question. Why would you talk to him at all? And that all has to do with, you know, longer story, but it kind of has to do with Leon because, you know, he got out of jail before I had to go in, mm-hmm. which to me was so gross. And my biggest fear, I was terrified that he would go after Leon somehow, mm-hmm. my dog, because I felt like, you know, it seemed like his goal was not necessarily like, let me see how much money I can get out of her, which he did. It seemed like his goal was more, let me destroy this person, you right. know, because he did all these things that didn't make sense necessarily financially, but it was like as if he just wanted to completely take me down, mm-hmm. burn every bridge, just utterly destroy me. And so what's the one thing that he could have really like really, really hurt me is if he'd done doing something to Leon. And he would have known that logically, Leon would stay at my mom's house. Like, mm-hmm. if I'm going to be gone for, you know, almost 4 months, he loves my mom. He knew that he would be at my mom's house. It would have been really easy for him to, like, drive up there.
Right.
You know, wait nearby for my mom to let him out to go pee and,
yeah, and
you
do
know,
something.
Whistle, call him over, and that'd be it. So that was, like, my huge fear. And when he got out, it was just such a weird feeling. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at his social media, because I was like, what is he doing? What is he saying? It was just so weird. And he mm-hmm. started saying things that were clearly like meant for me. And so it's a much longer discussion. And
yeah.
I think anybody who's been through this kind of thing too, you're left with so many questions.
Yeah.
And you're like, even though you're never going to get those answers, you're certainly never going to get an apology and you're never going to get an acknowledgement, but you're left with so many questions that you're like, you know, mm-hmm. It's hard to not go there.
Yeah.
And I knew too that like, if he was kind of, if he was reaching out, like wanting to talk to me in a positive way, I'm thinking like, well, for my own safety, for Leon's safety, I would rather let him think that he's kind of still got his hooks in me.
Sure.
You know, and I can, you know, I could pretend. I could let him think that he might kind of still have a hold on me. And that's safer for me, you know? Right. I'd rather know what he's doing, what he's up to. I'd rather
So at this point, when you got out of jail, out of Rikers, the only thing you really had left was Leon. And that must have been scary, right? You had, at that point, lost everything. I think it's important to take the listeners back for a second and just let them understand the story and hear how it unfolds so that if they haven't seen the Netflix or they have, they can hear it through your voice. Before you started the restaurant, you had gone to college, you were educated. Just give me a tiny bit of background about your upbringing.
I went to like undergrad business school. I went and did what everybody there did, which was came to New York City, worked in investment banking, worked in private equity, then worked at a high-yield investment fund. Mm-hmm. And finance really wasn't my world. You know, I could have stayed in that industry and made a boatload of money. Right. But it's like I didn't feel like I fit in that world. And eventually I left and went to culinary school. And then
– did you want to be a chef or did you want to run a business?
I always loved food and restaurants and That was what I felt drawn to. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up working with somebody on his restaurants, and then we ended up opening Pure Food and Wine together.
Were you already a vegan, a vegetarian? What did you follow?
No, I mean, I never in a million years thought I would have turned vegetarian or vegan, and I've never really identified with the label, but I did very quickly. It was all the result of sort of one dinner, and we were this guy and I were kind of exposed to it at the same time. And we were working on a different concept to open something. And once we learned about it, the more we learned and read about it, and then also tried going raw, not just vegan, but raw. So everything we ate was like uncooked and fresh. And we felt like totally different people felt – and I already ate really well. Like I already ate a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables and I didn't eat a bunch of crap or junk food. And we just felt so much better. And then we decided to do the restaurant.
With that concept.
Yes. Especially because there was no – nobody was doing it in like a high-end kind of way. Mm-hmm. That's what we wanted to do. And the vision was really, you know, to create a restaurant that appeals to everybody, you know, so it's good. And when it was open, I think on any given night, if we'd like taken a poll, like who here is a vegan, probably less than half the people, I'm sure. You know, so many of our regulars just, they came there the same way they might. You know, you might go to a sushi restaurant one night, you might go for, you know, Indian food another night, and then you come to Pure Food and Wine and you have our food. So people really appreciated it, not just because it was vegan.
Yeah. So, and I think that's important to note because a lot of people that are not from New York and were not familiar with the restaurant maybe don't realize that and thought it was just this vegan place. But it was like a hot spot in New York, a place to be seen, a place to see a lot of celebrities. But not only that, the food was good. So you could eat stuff that you wouldn't ever eat at another time in your life if you were not vegan or raw, and you would be like, oh, wow, this tastes great.
Yeah, it was unique. It was really satisfying. It was fresh. And we had a really good wine list. Mm-hmm. Joey, who was in the film, you know, curated an amazing wine list. Our desserts were really good. And again, I can say like the desserts were phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the one coming up with them. You know, people sometimes would be like, you're such a genius. Your food's amazing. And I'm like, at that point, you know, I could take credit for like recognizing talent and developing it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was all the staff and the employees who came up with the recipes. And and so, like, I feel like I can brag about it because I'm bragging about them, not about me.
So, and that brings up a good point. You were not back of house, even though that's what you may have studied in culinary school. You became front of house. You were really known as the face of the business. People ended up coming to see you. What was that like?
In the beginning, I was back of house, kind of. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there were periods of time where, like, I'd step back there and help out. And so I was sort of both. But I wasn't, like, I wasn't the one creating recipes. I would just work with them, you know. Sometimes I'd suggest things or they would come up with new things and I'd say, well, maybe tweak it this way or that. But it was really mm-hmm. – and I do feel like I was good at recognizing who was really talented.
Yep.
Because we never hired somebody from the outside. Whoever came up to be like a chef or a sous chef or the pastry chef had always sort of started, you know, in a regular sort of a line cook type position and then kind of worked their way up. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it really was a special place. And there's something about that location and the beautiful garden in the back, mm-hmm. which is unique because it's really quiet back there.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, so many restaurants in New York, you're like eating on the street. Mm-hmm. Now you're literally eating on the street yeah. with like all those outdoor spots, but even just on the sidewalk mm-hmm. and it can be really noisy. But that Irving Place location's oddly quiet.
Right.
Even though you're just like a couple blocks from Union Square. And the garden's just beautiful, the trees, and we hung lights in the trees. Mm-hmm. And just something about that space felt, you know, was really special.
What was it like running front of the house?
Well, I also, you know, it was my role was so, I guess, kind of hard to define, mm-hmm. you know, because I, again, there were managers running the front of house in terms of like scheduling and mm-hmm. service and all that. But, you know, one of the things that I think contributed to my being in a sort of vulnerable state when, I call him Mr. Fox mm-hmm. because he sort of told me his name was one thing, then it turned out his name was something else. Mm-hmm. And I don't really like saying his name. And so I just call him Mr. Fox. It's okay, sort of like a character, but, that's what I call him. Yeah. So, you know, I had to do a lot of talking with guests and kind of that whole sort of schmoozing thing, which mm-hmm. wasn't something I'm natural at. I didn't love doing that. But, you know, very often people come from all over the world sometimes, you know, mm-hmm. and so somebody would be like, oh, I came from all the way from wherever, you know, and they wanted to talk to me. So mm-hmm. what am I going to do? Say no. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time, you know, engaging with customers, you know, sometimes people I knew, regulars. So there's a lot of like being social and talking. And so that felt really kind of exhausting to mm-hmm. me, like just really draining. And, you know, so I would just go home and feel kind of like depleted. And, right. You know, I think what I really needed was like the kind of partner that helps you with the business mm-hmm. At that sort of like, you know, partner level.
Right, sure. You felt like you were doing a lot of it alone. I understand that. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Sometimes in life, we're faced with tough choices and the path forward isn't always clear. I personally have been through a lot of trying times in my life, trauma, grief, for example. I think those are universal themes that people can really understand. I lost my fiance, Andy, in 9/11 and the pain was unbearable. Since then, I've gone through other traumas that didn't feel as big, but I still needed to talk to somebody. And having somebody I didn't know that well, but was really good at listening, felt like the right thing to do. And it was so helpful to me. I love that I can have someone to talk to that isn't one of my close friends that I can just confide in and feel like it's between us. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I signed up for this just the other day. I've already been matched to the most perfect therapist for me. I'm excited because I've already touched base with them and I have my first appointment in a couple days. So I will let you guys know how that goes, but I'm super excited to try this service. Let therapy be your map with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/understood today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, help.com/understood. Give online therapy a try at betterhelp.com/understood and get on your way to being your best self. So at some point, the guy you started this business with leaves or something, right? And then
yeah, after the first year. Mm-hmm. So we had just published a cookbook, mm-hmm. and then yeah, there's a whole story there, but he left. And so I was running the restaurant on my own. Mm-hmm. And then I also had launched One Lucky Duck, mm-hmm. as we renamed the juice bar and the takeaway One Lucky Duck. We had products. We were selling them in Whole Foods. You know, it ended up being in like 30 plus Whole Foods stores, all these other stores. We couldn't kind of keep up with the demand. And all these people would come to me and be like, this is an amazing brand and this needs to be, you know, national. And it was like all this opportunity was coming at me. And what was complicated is I had, you know, Jeffrey, the backer in the restaurant.
Jeffrey Chatterer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but I had started One Lucky Duck kind of like on my own. Okay. And I launched this e-commerce website. And really, it all needed to be combined because the businesses were really intertwined. Mm-hmm. And it really needed to be combined. And so I had found some people that were going to put money in and we were going to recapitalize. And, you know, I set up like a new holding company that would own all of it. And then it was 2008 when there was like financial crisis. And so mm-hmm. people kind of suddenly didn't have the money they thought they'd have. And Jeffrey, you know, understood that I had wanted to consolidate everything. So he agreed to sell me the restaurant mm-hmm. for, you know, what had gone into it. So it was $2 million. So basically I owed him that money, mm-hmm. but then I owned and operated the restaurant all on my own.
Right.
His company was no longer involved from like a management perspective.
So you had some debt there, obviously, that you had to repay, but it was to Jeffrey.
Yes. And I also, like, even coming into that, I had debt from my situation with the guy before.
Okay.
Because of his business.
Oh, and you took on that debt.
That wasn't, okay. Yeah, that's a whole other story. So, okay.
But it seemed manageable, the debt, because you had this asset now and you could make money.
It was manageable. Yeah, it was manageable, and there was sort of, you know, it was understandable debt, the same way that some people have, you know, student loans or whatnot. It's like everybody looks at that and they understand it. It's like, okay, you know, you're so.
And you were doing your best to repay this debt monthly or whatever it was, and you would go to Jeffrey Chatterer and you would give him a check here, $10,000, $100,000,
whatever. Yeah, and he was so, like, he knew. You know, he knew I was trying to make the business work, especially, and then, you know, it was 2008, like so many restaurants in New York closed, and we didn't, you know, and I also, you know, a lot of that time, I didn't take any salary myself for a long time, so I wasn't paying, you know, I was late on my own rent, and, you know, but we made it. We, you know, staff was always paid, and I think, you know, because the restaurant was really unique, we did all right. It's not like people stopped coming.
Right.
So,
and you were probably getting a lot of press for the celebrities that did go in there, right? I mean, I would see on Page Six a lot who was there. I mean, can you name some of the people that would come in often or that have been there?
Well, I mean, the most memorable guests were like Bill Clinton, you know, that was exciting. He came in a few times, you know, Howard Stern, who then ended up like talking about it the next day on the air. Mm-hmm. I think they put a little clip of that on Bad Vegan, but you know, I saw lots of like musicians and actors, and I think one of the things we did well too was that we were very careful about people's privacy.
Yeah.
So sometimes things ended up on Page Six. Usually that was sort of like bigger, I don't know, like Janet Jackson or.
Yeah, sure.
I can't think of who else was in Page Six, but we had a lot of really big names there, and we just were very – I was always very protective of them. So, sure. Like, I would watch – kind of stand way back. And, you know, like, if I saw another customer get up to, like, approach the table, I would just, like, glide in between and be like, can I help you?
Yeah.
Like, so I was really protective of people's privacy.
Yes.
And we had a private dining room in the back, too, that sometimes we used for, you know – bigger names who came in that might want some privacy.
Right.
So, yeah.
So now at this point in your life, it doesn't sound like you were dating anybody and you end up getting your beloved Leon. Tell me the story of how you got
I was. Him. I did. I had a boyfriend.
Oh,
so
okay.
He was but it was such a – it was the best relationship because I'd been through a challenging relationship with the guy who I opened the restaurant with. And that was, like, very difficult. And then – I met this guy. He was much younger. And we lived together for 4 years. No drama. We never fought. He was kind of like an old soul, mm-hmm. you know, really creative, wise, mm-hmm. like such a good person. Loved his family. We'd go back to Colorado where he was from. And it was just a really good relationship. And I knew – I was sort of reluctant in the beginning because I thought, you know, I was 30 – I was 34 and he was 21 when we met.
Okay.
And so I just thought like, well, this is not going to work because he's going to like – you know, he's going to find somebody younger and mm-hmm. like that's it. And that's going to – that's going to hurt.
Yeah.
But he sort of – you know, he said to me like – you know, he kind of made these arguments like, well, maybe I'm worried that like some, you know, some guy is going to show up in a fancy suit and sweep you off your feet. Because he was sort of a, you know, like a young skateboarding kind of scrappy, really talented musician. But mm-hmm. anyway, just a lovely soul. And then he's also made the very wise argument that like, you know, we could both like get hit by a bus next week or a meteor could hit the earth. So if we want to hang out with each other, why wouldn't we hang out? And I was like,
that's a good point.
Okay. And then, you know, 4 years we spent together. So, but I knew going into it that like eventually it's not going to last, mm-hmm. which was all right because I wasn't looking to get married or have kids, mm-hmm. you know, so I had that sort of.
Would you bring him into the restaurant with you? Did the
all
staff
the time.
Know him?
They all loved him. Okay. So he actually had for a little bit worked at the juice bar, but then we were like, ah, that's too awkward. And so I hired his best friend, Jonathan. Mm-hmm. And so also like his best friend, Jonathan, worked there, became a manager, like such a good guy. All his friends were great. Mm-hmm. They were all friends with everybody at the restaurant. He was there all the time. And I loved like, you know, I loved introducing them to people. I would hold his hand. I looked happy in mm-hmm. his presence, you know, mm-hmm. like I was excited when he, you know, sometimes I'd be at the restaurant and he'd get off work and be like, all right, I'll come by. And he'd ride his bike over and show up all sweaty and I'd be excited. You know, it was just such a huge contrast to the way things were with Mr. Fox. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, my staff really knew like
that there was something.
This is weird because it was so different mm-hmm. With this guy. And so, you know, but again, I knew it was going to kind of end eventually. And and then, it was 2010. So we'd been together for about 3.5 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's when I got Leon.
Okay.
Which, you know, was really helpful because then we ended up splitting up and having a dog is really...
It's really helpful.
It's really helpful, yeah.
IP Vanish protects every device you own. Your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IP Vanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio and take control of your privacy with IP Vanish. IP Vanish protects every device you own, your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IP Vanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio and take control of your privacy with IP Vanish.
So you have this dog. How do you meet Mr. Fox? You're single, you're working all the time.
I was working all the time. I was really – I'd never been heartbroken in my life. Mm-hmm. Like I just never experienced that kind of intense heartbreak. And so I just – and I was overworked. I was just exhausted. I was overworked, really sad, kind of depressed. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just would come home at night, spend time with Leon, and then – I had strangely, like, at some point before befriended Alec Baldwin, mm-hmm. and we sort of spent some time together and became close. And then he met Alaria at the restaurant.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And actually, so I ended up getting Leon after I met Alec. And the reason I got Leon is because I was trying to convince Alec to get a dog. Mm-hmm. You know, I was so overworked and exhausted. Like, I thought, I can't. It never occurred to me to get a dog. Like, it just didn't even occur to me. And so I was trying to convince him to get a dog because I thought, like, you know, he's alone. I was like, you need to get a rescue dog. Like, it'll bring love into your life. Mm-hmm.
Why was he having conversations with you about being lonely, or did he come into the restaurant alone or something? What made you
think that? I just thought, you know, I just thought he should have a dog, you know, and yeah, he was single at the time. And mm-hmm. So I would send him, you know, I'd be like, this dog, this is a cute dog. And then I stumbled on this picture of a dog who was named Quinn in a shelter. Mm-hmm. And there was something about his picture, and there was something about it that I was like, this is the dog. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, you have to get this dog. Look how cute. Whatever. You have to get this dog. And he wasn't really interested in getting a dog. And then I just kept thinking about this dog. It was like there was something that was grabbed me, mm-hmm. and I didn't know what it was. And I remember one night I woke up in the middle of the night, and I was crying about the dog.
Oh, my gosh.
My boyfriend was there, and he was like, yeah, what's wrong? And I was like, I don't know. I keep thinking about this dog. I don't know what it is. I keep thinking about the dog. And then I had this thought, this cat that I had that I was very bonded to. Mm-hmm. You know, I had two cats, their brother and sister, but the boy cat, we were like, you know, we had that thing. Mm-hmm. And he died, and he had died in March of 2010. And I was laying in bed thinking, like, this dog Quinn, they said, is 5 months old. March. Huh, I must have been born in March. And I just, I don't know. But anyway, so.
The signs aligned for you with Leon, yeah.
Yeah.
Or Quinn.
And it really, it's hard to explain, but it felt like I had no choice.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, well, I'm just going to print out the application. I'm just going to look at where the shelter is and just in case. And then I finally was like, all right, well, I'm just going to go see him. Mm-hmm. I was like, on the way, I'm just going to buy a collar. And then I, you know, I went to see him at the end of the day, and then I was like, okay, I have to get him.
Right.
And so I knew I was going to come back the next morning, and I did. I came back the next morning, and I was like on the subway crying. I don't know why. I was crying really hard because mm-hmm. I was so freaked out, like as if, you know, early that morning somebody else came and adopted him. Right. I would have been devastated. So it just was a feeling like I'd never had. It was like something was pulling me to get him. And again, you know, I lived in my office. So my sort of corporate office, I had like four or five people that worked in what would be the living room of an apartment. Mm-hmm. My bedroom was in the back and an office in the back. Mm-hmm. And we had product all over the place, computers, cords, stuff, like getting a five-month-old pit bull, really?
Like, yeah.
But I had to, and I got lucky too because he, for some reason, was a very good boy and didn't – he wasn't one of those dogs that, like, chews up everything. Mm-hmm. So it worked out.
Right.
But it just seemed kind of – people would say to me, why are you getting a – you know, why don't you adopt an older dog or a small dog? And I was like, that's not the point. I don't want a dog. It's just that one. So Leon clearly meant a lot to me, mm-hmm. and I'd written this very long blog post about it, which I think – you know, Mr. Fox would have read everything I'd written online and then sort of really understood my psyche and what mattered to me and what was important to me and therefore kind of, you know, what I might be vulnerable to. Mm-hmm. And so I think he later sort of, you know, weaponized a lot of that information.
Right. So let's get into how you met Mr. Fox.
So then what happened was Alec joined Twitter. He's very funny, you know, he's very witty and quick, and he's very funny on Twitter, and he had just joined. And I think what must have happened is this guy, Mr. Fox, somehow, like, early on had some back-and-forth banter with Alec, who then followed him. And so by the time I sort of saw this person interacting with Alec, I sort of thought they knew each other.
Right, like he must be safe.
Right, he must mm-hmm. be safe. I thought they must have somehow known each other. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Fox, you know, red flag number one, was one of those people who, you know, his handle wasn't his name. Nothing really – there wasn't like a name and a person and a bio. You mm-hmm. know, very often, like, you know, I'm on Twitter, my name, my birthday, like links to my website.
Sure,
you know
sure.
who I am.
Transparent.
Right.
But he wasn't. Yeah.
So he wasn't. But I just assumed, you know, it just gave him like some legitimacy that I thought, like, Alec was somehow friends with him. And so we would sort of banter back and forth. He followed me. I followed him. DMs. And he just seemed very intriguing. So he would just drop these little things kind of, you know, implying that, like, he's somebody important or implying that something that got me really curious. And so, you know, it started this sort of flirtatious back and forth. And then we started, like, playing words with friends together. And then we talk and the messages there. And then it went to, like, then we exchanged numbers and we started talking. And it was this long process. And then, you know, he'd show me, like, a picture that was kind of like half his face, you know. And of course, it was like angled in a way that he didn't look like he later looked.
Right. So he looked chiseled instead.
He looked chiseled and had this like nice mouth and a, you know, 5 o'clock shadow. Mm-hmm. And then it was like a little more and he had sunglasses on. And, you know, so it was just this like slow reveal, which, you know, I think is certainly a way to kind of psychologically get you hooked, or at least almost hooked the way you would get hooked on a TV show if you're like getting hints and you kind of want to know more.
Yeah, right. And he said his name was Shane Fox, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shane Fox. So, yeah, it just kind of went from there. And I think it was strategic on his part to, you know, to kind of keep up this communication for quite a while before we actually met in person. Mm-hmm. Because by the time we met in person, like, he sort of did a number on me such that I got kind of hooked before I'd even met him.
Right.
Which is kind of embarrassing to admit that I felt that way. But he got me at a time when, you know, I was super depressed. Mm-hmm. My already crappy self-esteem was, like, even crappier, you know, because my younger boyfriend left and moved to Colorado and all his friends moved back to Colorado. Wow. And so I just felt sort of like abandoned. And, you know, I remember I like had this crush on this other younger guy and he completely ignored me. And so I just like, I was just feeling like crappy. And
so you were in a place in your life where somebody could swoop in, say all the right things and it would get you.
Yeah. And it would just be there. And he wasn't like, he wasn't my type, really, but he was such a contrast, right? So that, like, if I felt sort of depressed over my younger boyfriend who, you know, was very chill and easygoing and, you know, worked so well because he wasn't, like, the jealous type. He was never – you know, he wasn't possessive. He wasn't jealous. I couldn't handle any of that. He was very, like, you know, I'd have business meetings with, like, men, and he was fine with it, which – was great because I was fine when he would go out with his friends. Like, it was a very, like, really just healthy, good relationship. So, but Mr. Fox was like, you know, I'm a big, strong guy and sort of implied this whole military background and, you know, like, he could take care of stuff. And he also, I think he fed me a lot of stuff that he must have known I wanted to hear. So, you know, he would kind of praise me about the business and like, you're going to change the world and you're doing something so important. And, you know, it's so impressive what you've done, and would really kind of build up, you know, feed that part of me that maybe wanted that, you know? So whatever, he knew all the right things to say.
So he finally comes to New York and you meet in person.
Yeah. And it was like not what I expected, but it was just, I mean, I write all of this stuff in detail in my book, and I think I probably, you know, talked about it in the, in Bad Vegan. But after that first weekend, never mind that I slept with him. Gross. I'm sorry. Just like, I don't, but I had so much invested in it.
Right.
That.
Well, at that point, were you like attracted to his personality and you felt like you had chemistry? I mean,
yeah. And also, like, when I first met him, he didn't look the way he looked in a lot of the, you know, he didn't look the way he looked later on. So he kind of looked like, he sort of looked like the way, you know, some football players are like, like, especially meaty. The defensive ones are, like, really, like, meaty. And he also implied that, like, he'd had an injury. I mean, he was, of course, very vague about what the injury was. But he implied that he had, like, some injury. So he wasn't, like, in his top shape, you know. And I'm like, I don't want to be all shallow. And, you know, so I'm not going to be like, oh, you're blubbery. Like, screw you. But
no, but I've definitely met someone online. And then you have such a chemistry in your personalities that when you meet them, if they don't look like somebody you would – say is your type, it almost doesn't matter because you're so into their personality. So I could totally understand.
Although it's like, knowing what I know now, I would advise against that because I feel like when you're in somebody's presence, because I've found people attractive who aren't objectively good-looking people.
Sure.
Because of, like, pheromones and because they're, you know, also their personality. Mm. But it's like a chemical thing.
Yeah.
You know? And I think also when you're in somebody's presence, you might get that kind of something not right here.
Yes. That red flag might appear when they could hide it over the phone.
Exactly.
Or in text.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how soon did you start bringing him in the restaurant?
That's another, like, should have been a red flag for me is that, like, I didn't want to bring him into the restaurant. And after that first weekend, I was sort of like, I was really confused. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I guess that's not what it – he's not really what I thought. And that's kind of – that's it. I just thought, like, well, yeah, that's it. I'm not going to see him again. But then he kind of, you know, those hooks that were already in there – you know, he kind of pulled me back.
Yeah.
And then I don't know how long it was, but maybe it was a few weeks later and it was like, oh, well, all right, whatever. And he came back and then it just was this process of like, cause he didn't live in New York. He lived in, the town in Massachusetts.
And he was very vague and he kept saying he had to go off and do something for
work. Oh, yeah. He was very vague.
Which was what, in special ops or something? Did he actually say that that's what he did? Or he just
was never
alluded.
Very clear about it, right? Mm-hmm. And again, another big red flag. Mm-hmm. It's very convenient for sort of a con artist to say that they work in some kind of clandestine thing because you can't like go
ask
on.
A
they
lot
don't
of
have
questions.
A LinkedIn profile, right? And I remember even asking about why he didn't have anything online and he had some excuse about his work and this and that. It was all bullshit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you meet somebody and you can't kind of verify who they are and what they do and you don't meet their friends and you don't see where they work and kind of get to see their history, huge red flag.
Yeah.
You know, just –
or at least you should find out about those things for sure and get some references, recommendations, something so you know exactly who you're dealing with. Yeah.
Yeah.
So at some point you start bringing him into the restaurant and your staff does not take well to him, correct?
No. Well, the thing is he was very charming, very funny and engaging. And so some people like, you know, Bonnie, who was in Bad Vegan, she's very funny, like one of the funniest people I know. And so they would kind of banter back and forth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it was very funny and they got along. He got along really well with Joey. And so it's like he clearly tried to get some people on his side. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, he befriended one of my friends and kind of got that person on his side. And then if there are people who he knew didn't like him, he'd sort of find a way to get them, you know, out of your life. I mean, that's something that these people do is they'll, you know, they'll find a way to isolate you. Mm-hmm. And if you tend to be the type of person that is kind of introverted and you don't have a lot of like very close friends, who are kind of all up in your business all the time, you know, it's like if you have that best friend that like knows everything about your life,
who,
you know, would watch this happening and would see the red flags, perhaps. So if you're like me and you're kind of more introverted and you don't have a lot of people in your life, like I had a lot of, you know, friends and people I was kind of close with, but I just didn't have time for a lot of that stuff. And I didn't have that like lifelong best friend.
Yeah.
The way, you know, my sister has that lifelong best friend since college. Not lifelong, but that person that just knows everything about your business. So, that just makes it easier for them to kind of isolate you where nobody's pointing out the red flags. So yeah, he did that. And then, you know, it just sort of like, I guess it started at one point him asking me for money. And I don't even remember exactly like what the circumstances were, how much it was. I remember it was on the phone. I remember he acted like it was just this like one-off, like I just need it right now. And it's like almost he acted like it was like life or death, you know? And I'm like, well, I can help him, I guess. Sure. You know? And then
at this point, did you think you were in love with him? Were you married to him yet?
No. But I guess I did, you know, whatever kind of hooks were in there. You know, he did get me sort of attached to something.
And you wanted to help him.
Yeah. And I think what they do is they find a way to, they find a way to get you attached because, you know, what he did is almost exactly like what cult leaders do and the way that cult leaders will pull somebody into a cult. It's just that in this case, it's very one-on-one. And so he's sort of almost like in this very slow, deliberate, nuanced way, like eventually made it seem like all the things that I really wanted to achieve in my life and my biggest hopes and dreams, I could realize like he was going to help me get there and he could help me get there. And it like over time morphed into something weirder and weirder where like he started talking about things that were not like normal.
Right. Even like not very, of this earth.
Right. Like very culty. Mm-hmm. The whole thing that they ran with, you know, about like Leon can live forever, which they sort of exaggerated, but and that again was not something he like came out with out of the gate. You know, he's like, it was just very slowly over time. And he would do these things that made me like, he'd do things where I was like, how did he know what I was thinking? How did he know who I was talking to? How did he know this? How did he know that? And some of it I still can't quite explain, but some of it when I look back, it's like, you know, like eventually he got into my email. Another thing these guys will do is like, they're all over your devices, everything. And so.
So he would pretend it was, he had these powers to know you and know what you were doing when in reality he was hacking into your email or your text to see what was going on in your life and then would act like he knew it all.
Right. Yeah. Or like, you know, he might, like one time I think he must have read an email, quickly deleted it. And then like said to me something about like so-and-so is going to call and then boom, the phone would ring and that person would call. And they clearly probably said in an email, like, I'll call you in 5 minutes. But he had gone in there and deleted it before I saw it. Things like that.
You're right.
So, but yet meanwhile, sort of more and more, I'm kind of like, huh, what? Confused and not knowing how to explain those things. So yeah, he just kind of dragged me into a weirder and weirder place. And then like somehow, even after he borrowed that money and then I didn't get it back. And then I don't quite remember what happened, but there were multiple times where I was just like, that's it. I can't deal with this guy. Like, and I would kind of mentally think like, all right, well, I'm just going to cut my losses. But then he would, you know, come back around and he'd be funny and say things and then he'd be like, well, I'm going to come back and I'm going to bring you money, you know, like, and then I'd think like, well, I really need it, you know.
Yeah,
like,
I want to get the money back.
I don't
want
to lose that money. Yeah. I could have paid, you know, I could have given that as a bonus. I could have done something for the business with it. I could have paid more debt with it. So I'd let him back in, you know, and then maybe he'd give me like some money, but then somehow by the end of the weekend when he left, like I'd have loaned him more money. I don't know. It's like the problem is that I don't – like I wish I could have somehow magically had like recordings of what he would say to me because it seemed like whenever he was in my presence, like he would get me to do stuff. Whereas, you know, he deleted all of our emails. He kind of took my phones. And so I didn't have all record of all our text messages. I was able to get some. But I actually was able to recover our G chats. Yeah, you know, people used to chat in Gmail.
Yeah.
So I was able to recover our G chats. And when I'm reading them, it's like, I keep talking back to him. I'm like, you're a liar. Fuck you. Like, just, you know, a lot of that is in there. And so even me reading that stuff after the fact is sort of trying to make sense of like.
But still, how did it get that far? Yeah.
Like, how am I sitting there going, you're a liar. You said this before. Why should I believe you now? Fuck you. You're full of shit. Blah, blah. I'd be like making fun of him, making fun of his stories. And then it's like, then I look at my records and it's like, you know, I sent him a wire for 50 grand, like these outrageous numbers.
Right.
And just it's, you know, over time, it's like your mind gets compromised and then you're sort of like, you're trapped because what happens is, the worse they kind of pull you into this bad situation, the more you feel like the only way out is through.
Right.
And so, and then it just gets worse and worse and worse. And so I'm kind of like psychologically, like you want to believe the thing because that would be like the way out where you get, you know, like, okay, everybody's paid back. I have no debt. I can grow my company however I want. I can pay whoever I want. I can, you know, do all these things I've always wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to answer to, you know, because I was also in a situation where I'd have a lot of like men that would come to the restaurant. They'd be like, oh, I want to invest in you and mm-hmm. let's grow your business. And I'd kind of get my hopes up and then they'd turn out to be kind of creepy.
Right.
Like, and so I just like so badly wanted to be like independent and empowered to grow the yeah. business the way mm-hmm. I wanted to, because it was also not a business that like I wanted to grow and then sell and do something.
You right. know, this and was you like, didn't want a partner who could, you know, change your concept or somebody you had to answer to. You didn't want to take yeah. money from some guy who wanted something from you
right.
didn't want
and
to
even,
give.
You know, and even like I worked in private equity. So I know very often when they invest in brands, they put in a bunch of money, mm-hmm. open locations everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're not really what they were. They're not as special. You know, they kind of – the integrity is compromised. And then their whole goal is to make money and flip it. And right. my goal wasn't to flip it. I didn't want to make a bunch of money. I wanted this brand to be something that outlasts me. You
right.
know, I like tattooed the logo on my arm. Like, yeah. this is me. So, you know, again, it's like he kind of put that fantasy out there. And he'd always get me to like talk about it. And he would encourage me to like imagine things mm-hmm. and what I want and picture this life. And so, yeah, I mean.
So at what point though, did you start to withdraw from the business a little where your employees were like, wait a minute, this isn't the Sarma that we know. And, you know, that they started to reach out to you and say, hey, what's going on? You were married at that point. Yes.
Yeah. And actually that was one of my problems. That was one of the things that really bugged me in Bad Vegan is because the director actually like spliced audio from one part of an interview with another part of an interview that like in a way that was completely not honest, because there's one part where I was talking about how I would talk to my accountant about tax consequences of getting a bunch of money, because he would always make me think that like via some bizarre means he like had access to all these funds, and so he was just going to dump all these funds on me and everybody was going to get paid back and yeah, I'd right. be independent and I could grow my business and blah, blah. So at one point, my accountant had said, you know, well, if you marry him, like, ha ha. But that was like, and then months later, down the road, at some point, he like convinced me to marry him, but I didn't want to marry him. He acted like I'd be protected and like everything he was working on, it would just be so much easier if I married him. And he acted like, I mean, it's embarrassing, but he acted like he was like part of this, like, you know, it's like, is it government? Is it like this, you know, sort of like, I don't even know what to call it. That's the thing. He always kept it very mysterious, but he acted like I'd be protected. Mm-hmm. And he always kind of kept me weirdly like scared of things that I didn't even really understand. Mm-hmm. And just was like, ah, this would be so much easier if we just got, you know, if we got married. And the way that I finally like agreed was like, oh, fine. It's like, oh, how romantic is that?
Did he get you a ring?
No.
Oh.
I didn't care. I don't. Like, even if I got married now, I wouldn't want a ring or I wouldn't care about that. But, and so we
so
went.
So it was not so some big love affair.
Oh, no.
And he got on
so we went to, we went to City Hall to get the, I think you get the, you apply for the license and then you're required to wait 24 hours before you actually get married. And so in the interview, I said, you know, I talked about this and how he sort of convinced me and I was like, fine, I'll get married. And I was like annoyed. And so we went to City Hall, got the license, and then within 24 hours, we were married. And so what the director did is he took that bit about me talking to my accountant, saying, my accountant saying, well, you know, he could transfer you money easier if you were married. Mm-hmm. And then I say, and then within 24 hours, we were married.
Right.
Well, that's not accurate.
Got it.
And what that did was that was like another data point that, you know, either something included or something left out that would give people sort of, you know, somebody watching that would question that or would look at that and think that I was like, ooh, I'm going to get a bunch of money, so I'm going to marry him. You know what I mean? Like, it just is another thing that would give people a reason to question my character.
Right. Well, you weren't
getting
any money.
And either way, it just wasn't accurate. So yeah. It was like
– But let's be clear for people that, again, might not know this story. He was promising you all these crazy things. He had said he was looking at an apartment. You guys were looking at an apartment for like $15 million.
Bonkers.
He went as far as, you know – putting in all the paperwork, right, and having some poor real estate person get really involved to the point where he thought you were going to make an offer, and then the money didn't come through, obviously.
Of course, right.
So there was a number of situations like this where it got your hopes up that your life was going to be better and that you were moving up and he could pay all your debt and it was super easy for him to help you with that. And so he was, you know, giving you all these things to look forward to and to count on. And
yeah.
One by one, they kept not coming through, correct?
And part of what – so part of the reason why I and sort of people like me is like I couldn't even wrap my brain around like pretending to buy a $15 million apartment and allowing me to hire a real estate attorney who I'd worked with before, who I ended up having to pay his bill, and like brazenly sort of, you know, marching through the apartment. The way he talked to the broker, he got the broker convinced of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like he'd shown the broker something that verified that he had the funds. And the broker was like, okay, you know, the broker introduced us to bankers at Barclays. The brokers introduced us to, you know, this very high-powered accountant. The broker was like, you know, doing all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, oh, well, the broker must have confidence that he has the funds because why would he have us go to this meeting at Barclays where they like – practically roll out the red carpet like we're, I don't know, you know, we have billions of dollars.
Right.
And, you know, we'd have these meetings with these bankers at Barclays as if we're about to dump, you know, as if we're like looking at, you know, what bank should we dump, you know, a bajillion dollars into?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of like, the whole thing just feels so strange to me. And watching him with such ease, like talking about this stuff, it's like
it was hard not to believe him.
Right. I didn't quite understand that, you know, now I understand that there's certain personality types that they can stand on a world stage, for example, and tell the most insane lies and just do it so naturally and not even like really care.
Yeah.
There's certain personality types that can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's obviously one of them. But so most people will, you look at that and you don't think that, like, you're like, well, somebody, would he really walk in there and lie? Like, that kind of stuff, that would make me queasy. I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And why would you do that if you were full of shit? And I could never quite make sense of what was really going on. So it was sort of almost easier to believe him. And also, like, if I didn't believe him, then it's
like –
he
would get angry probably.
No. It's like if I didn't believe him, then – he would be like the cruelest human ever because what would he be doing? He would be getting my hopes up, you know, like knowing how badly I felt and knowing, you know, that I was in debt and I was struggling and I worked so hard and this business was my whole life. And to get me to like, you know, because eventually it got really bad where he was having me borrow money from all these people. And so I'm getting more and more in debt. Mm. It's awful. And to do that to somebody and make them think that, like, there's this, you know, happy ever after, like, perfect outcome of not just relief from all the problems that he created and then the ones that I had originally, which were manageable. It's like for him to do that would mean he's like – that would be the most diabolical thing ever.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you – you know, it's like imagine if you told a parent with a sick child, ooh, I have the cure and, like, just do all these things and, like – and then, oh, never mind, I was kidding. You know,
right.
Like, you – I mean, that's not a great comparison, but that kind of – like, who would do that to somebody? That would be completely, like
– insane.
Beyond cruel.
Yeah.
Beyond cruel. So I couldn't quite make sense of that. So it was like, well, he can't be
cruel, but also for to what end? Like, it doesn't make sense why they would do that, the motivation behind that. So at what point, though, I think a lot of viewers, and then just, you know, to answer the questions in general, for someone who, I know people have said to you, you're so smart, how did you get to this point? But like, for someone who had their whole life invested in this business and was so good at it, loved it, that was their life. It was like your boyfriend, kind of, right? It was who you had a relationship with, being at work and yeah. your staff. I understand that because I have felt that in my past with my past jobs. I think I want to know, how did you kind of relinquish that power and like stop returning messages, stop going to the, to the restaurant and being there? How did he have that kind of control over you?
Well, one of the things about the restaurant was, you know, we were open for more than 10 years. And even like before he came into the picture, if you run a business and you have people that have been there the entire time, mm-hmm. right? And everybody's really invested in it, like just because it feels like their family and everybody's mm-hmm. been there a long time. And so, you know, when I was with my boyfriend before, like, I could go to Colorado with him for, you know, I didn't do it all the time, but every once in a while I'd go for 5 days, 10 days, and I'd be online and kind of in touch with everybody the whole mm-hmm. time. But, you know, I just remember coming back one time, like straight from the airport into the kitchen and just looking around and thinking, like, and even saying to this guy, Ben, who was a sous chef at the time, and I was like, you know, it's amazing that I can just go away and know that everything's in such good hands mm-hmm. and everything's running smoothly. Everything looks good. Everybody's happy. Everything's great, you mm-hmm. know? And I was like, it's amazing I can do that. And he said, he'd worked in other restaurants before. And he said, I've worked in other places that were kind of run on fear. And he said, this place is built on love. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh. And it was that kind of place. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it's like, I felt like, the weird thing is like I would do almost anything to protect that place. Mm-hmm. So the idea that he kind of got it all, you know, put me in a situation where I might have thought I was protecting it or thought I was doing something that would sort of, you know, ensure our future, ended up destroying it. Mm-hmm. And so he sort of pulled me away more and more.
Then did it become just hard to respond to messages where people were like, Sarma, I don't understand who this guy is or what you're doing or where you are? Is that part of the reason why you would kind of go missing?
The only times I went missing, one time I went where I wasn't responding is when he kind of told me, okay, this is it. This is the end. It's all coming together. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to wrap everything up for us. It's like all, you know. Everything is going to get paid back. And he had me go to Florida for some reason by myself. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, stay off comms. You have to be off comms. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh. And like, he would always talk about stuff as if, like, you know, as if he'd been, like, in the military. Mm-hmm. And I'd always be asking him, like, well, can I talk to so-and-so? And that's when the restaurant closed the first time. Mm-hmm. And
that's when the employees walked out.
The employees weren't paid, and mm-hmm. and I wasn't responding, and then they walked out.
Did you know that they were going to walk out?
No. If I had known, I would have, like, you know, I don't know what, you know, just done something, mm-hmm. like, got, I don't know, gotten back there.
And so, to be clear, they walked out because they weren't paid because you had given the money to Mr. Fox, right?
I mean,
and
all
there was,
along.
And there was no money to pay them.
He was pulling money out. There was, like, money coming. You know, it was like I'd barely make it to pay them. Mm-hmm. And it was just this constant, like, you know, again, it's like in cults where they're like, oh, this big thing is going to happen, and then it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But then the people still believe it, and they keep going, and they keep going. And so it was a little bit like that. Like, you know, he would tell me, oh, my God, all this, you know.
And you know it's hard to believe it. But you want to believe it. So it's almost worse to say, forget it. This doesn't make sense, because then you're at square one. You lost all the money. You don't have anything to believe
in. Right. If you say forget it,
yeah.
Like, you're not just at square one. You're like –
you're behind. Yeah.
And also, like, in a situation that you can't even explain, you can't mm-hmm. understand, like, what is going on here.
Right.
And so you know, and he would keep saying like, oh, like this is it. You know, the money thing's over, you know, which like as if I was done. Mm-hmm. Okay, just this one more time kind of thing. So it's almost like, you know, weirdly, because turns out he was gambling away all this money, which is just so gross. But it's almost like that, like what must happen, I assume. And I've always like hated gambling, not just because it makes me so nervous and just seems very predatory. And so I've like, I'm not somebody that likes gambling, but I understand now that like if you were gambling and it was like all this stuff was riding on it, and you gambled away all this money, but you keep thinking like, okay, well, if I just put this one little bit more in,
then I'll get
then
it back.
It'll wash away. Not only will I get it all back, but all the shame of what has happened here is gone, right? Mm-hmm. So there must have been something like that going on where he would be like, no, 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 like this is all going to be over, like, blah.
Yeah.
You know, all of this is going to come through. And I'd be like, I'm already in such deep shit.
Right.
Like, this is terrifying. Like, I guess.
But he never got honest with you and said, okay, I have a gambling problem. This is where the money's going. Just let me win this back one time. It was never transparent like that. It was always about these mystical
things. Once I knew he was going to a casino, he acted like I don't even know how to explain it. He acted like almost like the casinos were like his bank. And he did, you know, because eventually he brought me there. And I would watch him go to these slot machines and always win, always win. And I would see these other people there, too, being like, this guy's got, like, a magic touch. He always seems to win. And he acted like it was some almost, like, magical power that he could do that, you know? And I couldn't really explain it. And also, when he took me there the first time, it was like everybody treated him like he was
someone, which they do at every casino if you're a gambler. But yeah.
Exactly. So, and I also, like, I'm pretty sure, and I always thought that, like, more people were going to come out of the woodwork once Bad Vegan came out, because I feel like he has to have been taking money from other people, too, at the same time. I think he had all kinds of different things going on, and I have some suspicions about it, but I don't know for sure. But I feel like he has to have been working other people at the same time, because he would disappear sometimes for days. And I feel like there has to have been times where – I feel like he has to have been getting money from other people at the same time. And then – and I also – you know, I don't understand, like, if he – I don't understand the extent to which, like, he has some kind of a, like, illness where he's – actually delusional himself, or was this just some sort of like sociopathic game, you know, because they don't really care about money one way or the other. It's like, oh, easy come, easy go. Like, it doesn't really phase them the way it kind of freaks out normal people. That's why, like, sociopaths are really good, you know, Wall Street traders, because that risk, most of us would kind of freak out over taking like these high risks and making bets like that. We would just freak out because losing would be so devastating, whereas they're like, eh, they don't really care, you know? And because, you know, having that psychology, it's like they almost – they need the thrill. They need that constant stimulation. So also, like, he would always play, you know, at different times. Like, he was always playing, like, Call of Duty or, like, different video games. And the more I read about other cases and other situations, that's very common. It's like they need that constant, like – kind of adrenaline thing going on.
Right.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled M-I-S-S, understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.
IP Vanish protects every device you own, your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IP Vanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio. and take control of your privacy with IP Vanish. IP Vanish protects every device you own, your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IP Vanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio and take control of your privacy with IP Vanish.